Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This is the 800th Tech Guy show, originally recorded on Sunday, August 28th, 2011. Please enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by Gazelle, the easy way to sell or recycle the used gadgets lying around your home or office. Don't just sell it, Gazelle it. Gazelle your used gadgets today at gazelle.com. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. It's time to talk about technology, you know, computers, the internet, cell phones, camcorders, MP3 players, home theater, all the jazz that's filling our lives, and probably to most people, just feels like a kind of constant background drone, a buzz of fear, guilt, apprehension, incomprehension, bafflement, frustration. And that's what I'm here to cut through. I'm here to make this stuff easy as pie for you so that you can understand it, so that you're comfortable with it, you lose the fear, the apprehension, the worry, and you just go, wow, this isn't so complicated. I think I could use this for maybe work, for maybe having some fun. I could maybe get maybe I could write that novel I've been thinking of, or take up photography, or maybe I could start creating some videos or some art. That's what this show is about. This show is about making it comfortable for you, giving you the understanding you need to use this stuff to change your life, to make your life better, to change the world. See, not asking much. Hey, let me give you the phone number. If you've got some of that fear, loathing, doubt, or mistrust, call me. 8888-ASK-LEO. I'll put your mind at ease. 888-827-5536. I'm like the computer psychotherapist. It's going to be okay. The computer Buddhist. 8888-ASK-LEO. I'll make you feel better. 888-827-5536. That's toll-free from anywhere in the U.S. If you're outside the U.S., you can also call via Skype out, something like that, and that won't cost you anything because it is a toll-free number. I'm here to hold your hand, to make it all better, to soothe you. But I have a secret agenda because I really do think this stuff is pretty cool and I want you to be able to use it. And you can't use it if it makes you anxious, can you? Nothing to be anxious about. It's interesting because there was a good article. Oh, I'll have to find this article. Written by one of those intellectual types, the university types that study these things. And she said that whenever there's new technology, it's always the women and children who are considered to be the victims. You know, the people who will suffer the most from this new technology. They used to think that cars that traveled more than, you know, 20 miles an hour, faster than the fastest horse could run, were dangerous. Most particularly dangerous to women because it would somehow affect their ability to reproduce. It's Genevieve Bell wrote this. She's the director of Intel's Interaction and Experience Research. And she calls it moral panic. She says there's a good article. I'll give you a link in our show notes from the Wall Street Journal. She says, we've had moral panic as long as we've had technology. It's one of the constants of our culture. And it's always the women and the children. Think about the children. When we started electrifying homes, putting electricity in homes, people said, you'll make women and children vulnerable. Listen and see if this sounds familiar. Predators will be able to tell if they are home because the light will be on and you'll be able to see them. Electricity will make women more vulnerable. Children will be visible, and it will be predators who seem to be lurking anywhere who will attack. Doesn't it sound a little bit like how people reacted to the internet 5-10 years ago? The railway trains. Women's bodies are not designed to go at 50 miles an hour. It was thought their uteruses would fly out of their bodies as they were accelerated to that speed. What you want to look for, she says, in a technology that will cause moral panic, it'll change. They have to change three things: your relationship to time, your relationship to space, and your relationship to other people. If it does that, the telephone, electricity, the printing press, the railway train, the automobile, the computer, the internet, if it does all that, we will suffer from moral panic. Television. She says the first pushback is going to be about kids. Is this making our children vulnerable? That's natural, I think, because, of course, our strongest instinct is to protect children. Will it make them vulnerable to predators, to other forms of danger? We'll immediately then regulate access. The problem, she says, is that cultures change much more slowly than technology. And boy, that's more true all the time as technology ramps up and accelerates. As soon as mobile phones became ubiquitous, people started worrying about phones. And you'd see comedy. You'd see TV jokes about people walking into walls because they're staring at their phones. You'd see people, and you do today, complaining about the fact that everybody's got looking at their phones. So I just wanted to kind of stimulate in this conversation, in your mind, the thought that perhaps our initial reaction to this stuff is nothing new, but perhaps not necessarily appropriate. Maybe this stuff doesn't hurt women and children first. Maybe technology isn't going to make everybody vulnerable. It just takes us a while to get used to it, I think, to absorb it, to become comfortable. And then we move on, and then there's something else, isn't there? There's always something else. An interesting article. I'll put a link in the show notes to this Genevieve Bell. Reason I've been thinking about this a little bit is I was served on a jury a couple of weeks ago. We didn't get to deliberate. The judge threw the case out of court, dismissed the prosecution, sent the defendant home saying, you were the victim of moral panic. It was a case that a crime that occurred, or alleged crime that occurred. In fact, no crime did occur. In 2005, when we were all afraid of the internet and the predators online, and it was one of the NBC to catch. Remember the NBC Dateline to Catch a Predator show? It was one of those cases, and it was just fascinating to watch because really a lot of what was going on here was this fear of the internet, and groups arose, vigilante groups arose, like the one in the case, Perverted Justice, they're called, that went out to try to entrap predators. Originally, Perverted Justice didn't involve law enforcement. They would just try to get guys to hit on supposedly underage children. Of course, these were all adults in chat rooms, and then publish the transcripts online. And they even went farther than that. They would publish the name of the transgressor, the name of his family members and coworkers on their website, encouraging people to call and bug them. That's true vigilante justice, isn't it? The judge decided that the whole thing was entrapment and threw it out, which I thought was quite astute, to be honest. And it really was that moral panic that we had. Have we calmed down a little bit about the idea of predators on the internet? You know, the facts don't really bear that out. Predators are mostly, unfortunately, people the children already know, 90% of the time. But I think that the idea that the internet comes into your home is somehow pretty scary for people, and that your children have access in the home without leaving their bedrooms to the seamiest side of the world is terrifying. I understand that. But I want people to balance it because it also gives kids the access to the world at large. When's the last time you had to go to a library to look up a fact? It's all at your fingertips. There's a lot of positive, too, isn't there? 8888 Ask Leo. Let's talk about it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, I forgot to mention Gazelle.com. Gazelle.com. The place to go if you've got old, who doesn't have old gadgets lying around gathering dust instead of collecting the money that they're worth. Every day you leave that gadget lying around is a day it's worth less. So today would be a good day to go to Gazelle.com and find out how much your gadgets are worth. Put them all together, throw them in a box, and Gazelle will pay the postage. You ship it back to them, and then all of a sudden you've got cash. Hard American dollars in your pocket. Or PayPal, Amazon or Walmart gift card. You get a 5% bonus with an Amazon gift card. You can even ask Gazelle to donate the value of your gadget to charity. They'll do charity drives. All right, Stephen, what's something old and you want to get rid of you've had lying around in your house that mom is saying, how about, I bet you have, what's, do you have an old Sega Genesis? An old hard drive. That'd be good. I'm just curious if the Genesis is worth anything. Nope. So this is good, too. If it's not worth anything, you press the recycle button, and you still put it in the box, but they will recycle it and recycle it responsibly. They don't put it in the landfill. No landfill at all. All the metals are removed. Everything that can be taken out is, and they don't ship it overseas. All right, you said he has an old hard drive. Maybe he's got one of those. A Seagate. All right, let's see what we got here. An old Seagate hard drive. Maybe one of those Free Agent Goes. I have actually about four of these. I bought a bunch of these when they came out. Is it work? I'll say normal wear and tear on this one. Slight wear. It works? Okay. It's not going to be worth a lot. You have the original power adapter. I don't have the original box or the software, but I do have the original cables. They're going to give me $4. Not worth a lot, but hell, I'll throw that in the box. You see this graph they show you how the price suddenly plummeted in April. It's really interesting. Now, of course, if you have something, you know, really valuable, like, say, an iPhone. I'll tell you, you know, iPad, 16 gigabyte Wi-Fi, $227. Kindles, a Kindle 3, $66. iPhone 3GS, $177. MacBooks from $41 to $265. Gazelle is a great place to recycle, reuse, and get money to boot. So here's the deal. Go to Gazelle, G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com. Put in all your stuff. Put it on the box. Ship it back to them. And you'll get a check. In fact, if you mention, actually not mention, but if you get an Amazon gift card from them, and if you buy on Amazon, that's a good deal. They'll give you an additional 5% on that. I think that's great. Gazelle.com. Don't just sell it. Gazelle it. And don't forget, when they ask you where you heard it, say, I heard it on the Tech Guy Show. Actually, I should take that offer code out because there isn't an offer code anymore. Just say, I heard it on the Tech Guy Show. That's the key. Don't just sell it. Gazelle it. Our heart goes out to our friends and family on the east coast of the U.S. of A., where, of course, Hurricane Irene, now Tropical Storm Irene, hit. And I know a great many of our listeners are listening on transistor radios today, including Dr. Mom on Long Island and my mom in Providence. So hang in there. Help is on the way. We talked a little bit about yesterday preparing for these storms. And, of course, if you prepare the day before, you're really, it's almost too late. The time to prepare is now for the next one. And fortunately, my mom was able to get, and I thought this was great, a phone that plugs into the wall but not into the plug socket. A phone that doesn't need power. We should all have one of those somewhere. You could put it in a closet. You could You can put it in the garage. Mine's in the garage where I would never even see it. I don't hear it ring. But the thing about this is, even if the power's out, these phones work if they're connected to the phone company. Now, Some people use their cable company for their phone system. And you'll notice that those usually installations have a big battery on them. That's because they do require power. And they will only last as long as that battery lasts. So make sure if you do have a phone system provided by the cable company or a phone system that uses the internet, that those batteries are checked every year and replaced if need be. They only last a year or two. But the best thing is a phone that's connected to your local phone company, because the phone company provides power down that line, even during a power outage, and it still works. It's a miracle of ancient technology. My DSL provider gives me phone service as well. But their switch is in the central office of the phone company. And I asked them before I did this, I said, well, will this work in a power outage? And they said, yes. Just like the phone company, our switch is powered. You know, they have generators in the central office, and we'll send power down the line to a phone that doesn't have electricity. So that's good. But if you have a voice over internet phone, cell phone, you might think, oh, I don't need a phone on the cell phone. That's going to go out too when the power goes out. It's really good to have. You can just get a lifeline in there, just in case. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number. 888-827-5536. Norris in San Francisco. Hey, Norris. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Oh, hello. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. How are you, Norris?
I'm fine, thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I have a quick question. I read a book a couple of years ago, three, 4 years ago, by Dan Gookin called Buying a Computer for Dummies.
Yeah, Dan's great. I like Dan.
Okay. Well, the thing is, I wanted to know if what he says in the book three, 4 years ago is still the right way to buy a computer. First look for the software, and then look for the hardware to match the software.
Yeah, that's actually what I've been saying for years. Dan must be listening to me.
Okay.
Now, that's changed a little bit because what he's talking about is Windows versus Mac. That's okay. Really the choice. And it was more so 5 years ago that software you wanted might not be available on the Mac. I don't think nowadays it makes much difference. If you have a lot of existing software that you want to keep using, then you're going to want to keep using Windows or Macintosh. You don't want to have to reinvest. But if you use, for instance, Quicken for the Macintosh, you might be.
Well, I've never had in my life.
Yeah. Oh, you have no computer.
I have no computer. I want to buy one.
First computer. How exciting.
I'm sorry?
First computer. That's exciting.
Right, right. Well, the thing is, I don't, like I said, I don't want to have buyer's remorse where he says people who buy the hardware and then look for the software have buyer's remorse.
Yeah, I don't know if that's true anymore.
Yeah?
I think that, especially for your first computer. You don't even, so here's where it would apply. For instance, if you were a business person and, like, say, a realtor, and all the realty software that you needed to use was Windows software, then that would apply. But okay. Nowadays, what most people are doing is the internet,
right?
Email, that works both the same on Mac and Windows, exactly the same. Because of cloud computing and the power of the internet, a lot of what you do doesn't actually matter, happen on the computer. It happens in the sky, on the cloud. So I wouldn't really worry, unless there's some very specific software that requires one or the other. I really wouldn't worry. What do you want to do? It is still the question. What do you want to do? What do you want to do with your computer, Norris?
Right. That's what he says in the book. He says, unless you have a purpose in mind, I don't see the purpose of buying a computer just because everybody else has one.
Oh, Dan. I'll give you a slightly different gloss on that.
Okay.
Even though I'm the tech guy, I'm not a technology bigot. It's really true that you shouldn't feel pressure to get a computer. You shouldn't feel like because everybody has one, you have to have one. But right. If you have the inclination,
right?
If you're interested, if you think you might be able to use this, absolutely. And you might consider, well, how important is email these days? Doesn't everybody say, I want to email you something?
Correct.
So more and more, I mean, that's one thing that has probably changed over the last few years. More and more, people expect you to have a computer just as they expect you to have an answering machine. You don't have to have an answering machine. But if you don't, expect to get a little flack from people who say, well, I can never reach you.
Oh, I understand.
So it's the same thing where people say, I can never reach you. Why don't you? In fact, it's starting to be that way with a smartphone. I can never. that's the new pressure point, isn't it? So I think it's great to get a computer. If it's your first computer, do yourself a favor and get a Macintosh. Don't go with Windows.
Okay, and I guess that answers my second question.
That's a real definer these days. Not software, not what you want to do, because you can do most of the same things in both. It's, can you afford a Macintosh?
Okay.
Because Macs are more expensive.
Yeah, that's what he wrote. He wrote in the book that...
Still is. Still true. And in fact, maybe even more true than ever, because PCs in the last 5 years have plummeted in value. In fact, that's why HP got out of the business. They couldn't make any money. They were the number one PC manufacturer. They couldn't figure out a way to make money at it.
Well, that leads me to my second question. With HP going out of the consumer electronics business, does it make sense to buy one of their computers?
Absolutely not. Don't. Get a Mac. Please do yourself a favor, Norris. You will. Once you go Mac, you never go back.
Okay. Thank you so much for all your help.
You're welcome. I would look at, if you want a desktop, those iMacs are great. That's what I've got sitting in front of me right now. But if you're looking at a laptop, and in fact, I think for almost anybody, the real sweet spot these days, $999, it's $1,000. Admittedly, that's expensive. See, I've been around for a while, so it doesn't feel that expensive, because it used to be the computer you wanted was more like $2,000. So $1,000, wow, that seems like a deal. But the $999 MacBook Air, it's light, it's fast, it's convenient. It's not much bigger than an iPad. You carry it around, and you've got a full keyboard, you've got a full computer, you've got 64 gigs of storage. It's fast. I have to say, this to me, for most people, is the computer you want, especially because a lot of what you're doing is going to be on the internet, so how much storage you have isn't critical. The only thing missing, I wish they'd put in the MacBook Air, that's typical Apple, but I would really wish they would put a 3G or 4G wireless connection in this thing. Then this would be the computer, the best. There would be no question in my mind. You can buy an external dongle, or you can tether it, or use your cell phone for a hotspot. That's what I do. But boy, if the Air had 3G network, it would be online everywhere. It would be, this thing would be. I would never leave it. That's, to me, that's the best computer out there. MacBook Air. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. This is kind of depressing. Kyle Benham. Hey, Kyle's been doing a great thing. The guy who, Mr. Kyle Benham on the control board here. He's been doing a great thing lately. He put his playlist online. So we can put it, I don't know, James, if you put it in the show notes from yesterday. Kyle, are you going to do that every day now? Is put the bumper music online?
I will.
He does it in his Google Plus account. If you want to follow him on Google Plus, if you have a Google Plus account, it's Kyle, K-Y-L-E, Benham, B-E-N-H-A-M. You can follow him there. But what we'll do is we'll paste it into the show notes at the bottom. Because I know people are always saying, where does that music come from? Because Kyle likes to play music that fits the topic. I don't know how he's got, he's on the internet. I think he's not paying any attention to the show. He's just on the internet looking for stuff to play. Most of the time, he hears it. 8888 Ask Leo, what was the Billboard Carbonite?
You got it.
This portion of the show brought to you by, I do love these guys, Carbonite.com. It's backup done right, automatic, on the internet. If you're using, this is a perfect, we were talking about getting, Norris wanted to know his first computer, getting a MacBook Air. This is a perfect solution for that. You put it on the MacBook Air. And then whenever you're online, it just backs up. You don't have to think about it. Carbonite. It's backup done right. Try it free for 2 weeks with the offer code Leo. No credit card. Just by Dave. Buzz in Corona. Hey, Buzz. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hello, Buzz. Oh, wait a minute. I got to press the button. The bouton. Now I got you. Hey, Buzz.
Sorry, I'm on a AT&T iPhone, so I'm not sure if this call will drop or not, but...
Isn't that exciting? That's kind of fun, You never know. It's always a mystery. Actually, you do know, unfortunately, at least in the Bay Area. I don't know how it is in Corona, but in the San Francisco Bay Area, you know it's going to drop. It's just a question of when.
That's funny. I don't really drop that many, actually. It's just there's a couple of turns or corners that I know I'm going to lose it. But
that's all cell phones do that, where you get a dead zone. It's the handoff from one cell site to another that very frequently you'll lose the call. But I know that there's a tunnel I go through on the way to San Francisco. There's places I know I'm going to lose a call. It's the completely random, inexplicable call. And what happens on the iPhone is it says call failed. That's when you know it was the iPhone that just said, I give up. Call failed. Those are the words you don't want to see. And I tell you, I stopped using the iPhone because of that. Now, that's, I think, very much tied to where you are. So the if you're in a marginal area, as I am here in Northern California, you're going to get that more often. If you have good, strong AT&T signals, it's not a problem.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I'm a teacher. I teach in sixth grade in Corona here. And I wanted to tell you a little bit about an app that I created, but I have a question related to it. So let me get to my question first. I have the iPhone. I've got iPod Touch. My wife's got an iPad. And so I can beta test my app just fine on that. But my question is, I'm getting some requests for an Android, and I don't really want to have two phones and two carriers. So my question is more like, do you have a recommendation for something that I can, and I just mainly need to use it over Wi-Fi? So
well, first of all, the good thing about the Android development system is it has an emulator built into it. So as you're developing, you don't have to, because it's a pain, to be honest with you. One of the things that really slows down development on a cell phone is the process of writing the program, compiling it, updating it, and then copying it to the phone to try it. So most of the time, you'll just run the dang thing in an emulator. The nice thing about the emulator is you could set the screen size. You could say what version of Android. There's all sorts of parameters that you wouldn't have if you had an individual phone. I absolutely think you should run it on a phone before you put it out.
Yeah.
But that's no question. But, absolutely. You don't need to buy a phone right away. Develop it in the emulator, you know, right up to the point where you're going to ship it. Now, you're right. You do not need to buy it from a carrier. You do not need to pay data plan or anything like that. You can use it on Wi-Fi. In fact, you probably go on eBay and find an Android, Nexus One would be a good choice. One of the Google phones, one of the plain Google phones.
Right.
And get that and not hook it up, not put a SIM card in it, and just use it on the Wi-Fi. That'll get you 90% of the way. At some point, you're going to want somebody who has a 3G connection to try it and things like that.
Oh. Really?
Okay. Well, I think so. What is the app?
Well, the app is called StickPick. It's a teacher tool. It's something that a teacher would use, kind of like the old school popsicle sticks where you'd shake the device or tap it and it draws a name.
We talked about this before, I remember. That's really cool.
It's got a little more sophistication to it than just picking a random name. It's also got where you can actually, if you have a group of students that are like diverse, you can choose the kind of question stems you want to ask.
And oh, that's neat.
Screen when you pick the kid. But
is this... It's right now it's iPhone only.
iPhone, iPod Touch, and it does the double pixel in iPad.
Ah, very clever.
We're working on like a...
You don't have... What you're saying is you don't have a native. I got it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's certainly worth doing a native for the iPad. I think in education probably there are a lot of iOS devices more than Android, but I don't know.
I'm getting requests from teachers that are saying, why isn't this on Android? So I'm saying, well, I don't have an Android, but that's where I want to build that out to.
I think you go on eBay, you could get a cheap used Android phone. I would look for one of the Google phones, which would be a Nexus One.
Okay.
Or a Galaxy, what do they call a Galaxy S for Google? I had one and I can't even remember it. But I'd get a native Google Experience phone. There's a handful of those. Not too old either. I think the Nexus One would be perfect. And then you can try it on that. You don't have to put a SIM card in there. You don't have to have a data plan. You just use it on Wi-Fi. It doesn't sound like your program in any way needs to use 3G.
Right.
So I think you probably fine to test it that way. Ultimately, what you probably should do is grab a handful of teachers with Android phones. Those people who've sent you an email say, would you like to be a beta tester?
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea.
Nexus S, that's the name of it, sorry. The Nexus S or the Nexus One, either one of those would be a good choice because they're plain Google flavor.
So if I wanted to beta test it myself, I don't have to put it on a network first even for like one day before I turn it into a Wi-Fi device?
No.
No? Okay.
Welcome to the world of Android. What do you think? Do you think this is Apple? You're right, you can't do that without an iPhone.
That makes sense.
Yeah, you have to activate an iPhone, but no, this is Android here. That's why people choose Android, because they don't want the draconian restrictions of the iPhone.
Awesome. Okay, yeah. I like that. That sounds great.
This is the biggest challenge with developing for Android is the huge variety of screen sizes and resolutions.
Oh, I know. That's the thing, too. So is there a more popular, is the most popular one the best? And then everybody else, does it, I mean, can you tap on it?
No, you have to develop it in a screen-independent fashion.
Oh.
So, but that's possible. It's built into the operating system, the SDK. It allows you to, you know, it will resize widgets and stuff. You just have to think about it as you're doing it. That's where your testing is going to be. But you can do that in the emulator, because the emulator, you can have several ones. You could say one is VGA, one is XVGA. I want one for tablet. So what I would do is develop a resolution-independent application, and Android has the hooks to do that. Somebody in the chat room is pointing out, it's true, you could get an iPod Touch and use the Wi-Fi and test it that way. You're right. Apple does give you that capability. It's just the iPhone you have to activate, right? And the iPad. The iPod Touch, you don't have to. Buzz, that's really cool. Pickstick. We'll look for it on the iOS marketplace and on Android soon. Soon to be. I think it's really a good idea, in any case, whenever you're doing a program, to get a team of beta testers, pre-release testers together. Those teachers who wrote to you saying, we want an Android version, they'd be a great place to start. All you need is a handful of them, and you just say, hey, let me send you it. The nice thing about the way Android works, you can actually email an application to people. You email the APK file. The only thing they'll have to do is they'll have to go in the settings, and there's a setting in the settings that says, and I think it's in security, that says download from third-party sources so that they can get it from somewhere besides the marketplace. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888. Ask Leo. That's the phone number. If you have a question, we do write everything down that I say on this show. You can find the links to all of that on our website, techguylabs.com. I'm very pleased to say that tonight we launch the new Twit site. Twit is my podcast network. So that new Twit site goes up tonight. And then we start to work on the new Tech Guy site. Finally, finally, we can update the Tech Guy site. So what you see there is a holding pattern, really. But you know what? It's functional. All the information you want is at techguylabs.com. Also, a link to our great chat room. Over 1,000 people in there today. A link to the video. And a link to all of our shows, 799 previous shows. Yes, this is show 800. I don't know. Wow. Let's see. That means if it's show 800, that means in 2 years I'll be at 1,000. We should start planning the party now. In 2 years. And actually, I will be here in 2 years, unless, you know, God willing. Because we are about to execute a contract that'll bring me through 2013, December 2013, with Premier Radio Networks. I'm very grateful to them. They want me to stick around. In fact, that's why we're updating the website, because I realized, gee, if I'm going to be here through 2013, I better have a website that looks like at least it was invented in 21. Looks like right now, looks like it came from 1992. Okay, let's get back to the phones. 8888 Ask Leo. Eddie in Mississippi. Hello, Eddie. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
How you doing, Leo? Oh.
Thank you. I'm really doing well. I'm in a good mood today.
Yes, you are.
Because we didn't get washed away by Hurricane Irene.
Yeah, well, those people on that side, the coast is lucky enough not to get washed away, too.
I bet you in Mississippi you're used to this kind of thing, huh?
I'm from St. Bernard, Louisiana, and yeah, we are.
You've had a few hurricanes in your time?
One or two. I have what I think is the greatest phone I made. Probably I'm the only one that thinks that, though. I got the Palm Pre.
Oh, baby! You are what we call an iconoclast. Actually, you know, I loved the Palm Pre when it came out. I thought this WebOS is a great operating system. I really loved the way it handled multitasking. I just was really impressed. I thought, who would have thunk it? They could have come up with a new way to do a smartphone. Then Palm, of course, sold to HP. The big problem with the Pre was I think that the hardware was a little underpowered for the operating system. So it was just felt a little sluggish.
All right.
And the same
well, that and the phone never I mean, I'm probably on my 30th phone by now. But
boy, you know, that's true. My friend Ken Shepherdson, who was a huge Palm Pre fan, same thing. It would break every 5 seconds.
Correct.
They just were not well made, were they?
No, they shipped them to me, and I ship them right back. Don't leave the store.
So, Eddie, I hate to say it. I know you love your Palm Pre and everything, but you've been through 30 of them. It's a little sluggish. I mean, there's some negatives, aren't there?
All right, but the operating system, you can't beat.
I agree, and unfortunately, HP has decided it's not going to. Now, I have some good news for WebOS fans. That's the name of the operating system on the Pre. Good news is, it sounded like HP was killing the whole thing. They did a very, very, very bad job of announcing this. It turns out, after we got more information from HP, that really what HP was saying is, we're not going to make any more hardware. We're not going to make the touchpad. We're not going to do more phones. But WebOS is going to continue. They actually, I think, are going to keep developing WebOS and do what Microsoft does, do what Google does, is license the operating system to handset manufacturers. So I hope that's true. And I hope that the mismanagement of this announcement didn't actually kill the Pre. Because unfortunately, I think it's a widespread belief now among consumers that that WebOS is dead.
Well, let's keep the word going.
Yeah.
Calling you for, when will I be able to get another phone with the same operating system? And I was told that Sprint was going to come out with a new phone.
I don't think so. I think there's a good chance, unfortunately, that the whole thing is going to go away just because they did such a poor job of managing this transition. What they should have said is, we love WebOS. It's the greatest operating system ever, but we realize we shouldn't be in the hardware business. We should be in the software business, and we're going to license this to anybody who wants it. In fact, if I were them, I would do what Google has done and give it away. That's worked really well for Google. And there's ways to make money, believe it or not, when you give away a phone operating system. Google makes good money on Android. But HP apparently couldn't figure out how to do that or how to say it. And I think they may have inadvertently killed the business.
I hope not, because I tried the Android. I don't remember the style phone it was. And they said I had a 30-day return policy, and it took me about 3 days.
Well, you know, it reminds me of a great operating system that also died about 10 years ago called BOS. It was so beautiful. It was better than Macintosh. It was better than Windows. It really was slick, but it just didn't catch on. Apple came very, very close to buying BOS and making it their operating system. Instead, they bought Next, and they made OS X the next operating system. And after that, BOS went under. And the point being that this happens in the computer industry. It isn't the best, and this is depressing to me, but it isn't the best technology that survives. It's the best marketed, the best accepted. BOS was clearly more elegant and superior in many ways to anything out there. I think it was technically the best, but it didn't survive because the marketing and the uptake, and there's a lot of factors that go into the success in the computer business, in the technology business. It isn't always the best that live, alas. I'm not saying WebOS is the best. I think there were some issues with it. I think I probably prefer iOS, and I like the openness of Android. Android's clunky, but I like the openness. That's what I use as an Android phone. I do wish WebOS had survived. But I think given that we're going to have iOS, we're going to have Android, we're going to have Windows Phone 7, all are very strong contenders out there. Maybe there isn't room for a fourth. Eddie, my recommendation for you is to bite the bullet, give up on WebOS. And I think the people who are moving from WebOS would feel most comfortable with Windows Phone. I think the Windows Phone is actually the way to go. All the carriers, Verizon, Sprint, and T-Mobile, have Windows Phone. Sprint has some good choices. I think a Windows phone is the one you should go into the store and at least play with, maybe do that 3-day or 2-week trial. I think it's the closest thing out there to WebOS. Now, the good news on Windows Phone is because it's Microsoft And because they've done a deal with Nokia, Nokia's going to release a bunch of Windows phones starting this, I think this winter. A Windows phone will be around for a while, and developers know that, and so they've already got 30,000 applications. It's doing quite well. So if you're moving from the Palm Pre, as you probably should, look at a Windows phone. Donald's coming up. We're going to go to Murrieta, California in just a bit. He's running two operating systems. He has some questions about using our sponsors, Nod 32 and Carbonite, with the two, and I'll explain what to do. Oh, out of time. Dang, nabbit, how does that time go fast? Tell you what, Donald, hang on the line. We'll talk to you in just a bit. Also, Woody in Long Beach. He's got a kid's toy that's dead. We'll see if we can fix that. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, a good day to you, Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. And it's time, the singing tech guy. And it's time to talk computers, the internet, cell phones and camcorders, MP3 players, home theater and all that jazz. 8888 Ask Leo is my phone number. If you have a question, a comment, a suggestion, I would love to hear from you. If you're suffering from moral panic from use of the internet, I can help you. I can talk you down. It's going to be okay. 888-827-5536. That's the number toll-free from anywhere in the U.S., outside the U.S. Use Skype out and you can reach me. It won't cost you a penny because it's a toll-free number. Our chat room, our video, our podcasts, our audio, our show notes, and a lot more stuff, all available at the website, TechGuyLabs.com. TechGuyLabs.com. Well, let's see. Donald's been very patient in Murrieta, California. Thanks for hanging on, Donald. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. Nice talking to you again.
Great to talk to you.
My question was, I heard you talking the other day about running the two operating systems on the Mac. And my granddaughter was off to college, and that's exactly what we did. She's running Lion, and I loaded Windows 7 using Parallels on there for her.
Something deeply satisfying about doing that. I don't know why.
Pardon me?
It's very satisfying. You feel like, well, no matter what, I'm set.
That's right. I'm covered.
Yeah, I'm covered.
But there's something that I kind of overlooked. I also loaded Nod 32 on there for her security, and also Carbonite, but I loaded that in the Windows 7 mode. So actually, I'm not covered with the Lion operating
system. That's right. That's right.
I missed the boat on that.
Well,
I thought I was going to cover both, but I really only covered one.
Yeah, I mean, the truth is, I don't usually install an antivirus on virtual versions of Windows because even if it gets a virus, you just throw out the... See, I'm booting it up on my Mac right now. You just throw out the...
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, you just throw out the Windows port. You know, you can snapshot it in VMware, and you just throw it out if you get a virus, and then you start over. And so it's no big. It's like no biggie. It's not going to infect the Macintosh.
Oh, okay.
Now, as far as backup, yeah, that's an issue. And in fact, Carbonite, you could put it on one of the operating systems. It will only back up files it can see on that operating system. So.
Okay.
It's not ideal. I mean, she's working in Windows. What I would recommend you do, and you can do this in VMware, is share the Macintosh partition and work in the Macintosh partition. So that, do you understand what I'm saying? So if she's working using the Mac files, then you back up on the Mac side. I guess you could do it the other way around if you wanted to back up the Windows side, make sure she saves everything on Windows. But the problem really is that the Mac cannot read the Windows partition.
Okay.
So what I would recommend is share, you can do this in VMware, share the Macintosh hard drive. Maybe even not the hard drive, just the users, maybe the documents folder, share that. Make sure, now if your daughter's like mine, she saves everything on the desktop. So you might want to be backing up the desktop as well. But if you just take the documents folder and make sure that's visible on the Windows side, and then use Carbonite to back it up, I think you'll be all right there.
Okay, because I wasn't really that familiar with Lion, but I noticed that there is some sort of sharing there. Is that automatic, or do you have to...
That's part of VMware.
Oh, that's in VMware.
That's in your virtualization program, and that's a setting, and I guess by default, they make sure that you can see the hard drive.
Okay.
That's actually a good thing, because you'd like to keep your files in one place, not in two different places. Okay. Mac can't read the Windows partition.
Okay, local.
So.
Now, Carbonite is not available on the backup for the Mac yet, though, right?
Yes, it is. They updated for Lion.
Oh, they did?
Yes. Just this couple of weeks ago.
Oh, okay. That's neat, too. I didn't know about that. Okay, Leo, thank you for the information. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Donald. I think I said that backwards. Macs can read Windows. Windows can't read Macs. Does that make sense? However, the VMware will share it so that they can do that. I think it's a really nice solution. If, you know, again, Macintoshes are more expensive. That's the negative. But if you want to run Windows and Mac, the only way to do it is to buy a Macintosh. The only legal way to do it is to buy a Macintosh, put Windows on the Macintosh, and do a dual boot system. That's called Boot Camp. Apple supports that. Or use a program like Parallels, VMware Fusion, VirtualBox. That's the free one. VirtualBox from Oracle. And then you can run Windows inside the Mac, which is, you know, so you're running the Mac operating system and you want to open Microsoft Word for Windows, you just open it and there it is, which is kind of cool. Tarzana, California. Robert, you're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello, Leo.
Hello, Robert.
I got a big problem.
Uh-oh.
Here.
Yes, sir.
This is a weird story. In early August, I went to my local camera store and bought a ProMaster memory card for my Nikon DSLR camera. And while shooting pictures last night, a message suddenly appeared on my camera's screen that said, no files on disk. This was after shooting about 150 important family photos. Yep. And I could no longer find on my SD card photos that I had just taken. And on this camera, it's a D70S. It's nearly impossible to accidentally delete all the images because you have to press three different buttons simultaneously with two hands to do that. So when I returned home, I popped the SD card into my card reader, and thumbnail views of the lost images reappeared. And then they disappeared again. So I went online. And so I figured, well, this is good news in a way because at least I know these.
Something's on there. Here. Yeah.
So, yeah, there's something there. So I went online and downloaded a program called Card Recovery to try to recover my images. And this is where it gets weird. Card Recovery retrieved from my card a bunch of pictures that I took on a recent vacation and had erased prior to last night.
Good.
Okay. It recovered two of the pictures that I took last night, two of the 150 or so. And also, now this is where it gets weird, a slew of photos of people that I've never seen before that were dated in July, like 3 weeks before I bought this card.
Well, it was a used card, wasn't it?
I think I was sold a used card.
You certainly were.
So that is one issue, and I'm sure I can go back to the store and take care of them on that one.
Well, I think it's something to note for other people. If you use a camera memory card and return it, make sure, or you know, maybe it was somebody at the camera store that used it and put it back in the packaging without the owner's knowledge.
But
I would certainly wipe the card before you do that. And sometimes a reformat, they probably reformatted it, but reformat does not get rid of images.
Oh, my God. Well, so I got two issues. Obviously, I got to go back to the camera store with the card. That's the easy part. But at this point, I'm trying to retrieve the raw images that I took last night.
See, the recovery doesn't guarantee that you'll get them back. If anything, if they've been overwritten, it's weird because you would most likely get the stuff that's the newest back and least likely get the older stuff back.
Yeah.
In this case, but as you know, there's no guarantee that you're going to get anything back. It's just the way the file system works is whether that data area was overwritten or not.
Mm-hmm.
So, you might try another recovery program and just see if that gets you a different result. They're all doing the same thing. The one I recommend is a free one make sure I get this right. I always get this wrong. It's pcinspector.de, I believe, is the site. Yeah, Convar. And you'll see that there's an English and a German version of the site. Use the, depending on the language you prefer. They have a program called Smart Recovery. It's free. And it does kind of what it's designed to do, recovery from flashcards, the kind of card you have. So it's smart about the format of files on there. And so, you know, it knows it's looking for image files, for instance. So it might do a better job. Anyway, it's free. PCinspector.de. Now that's a good one. Kyle Benham. Very 80s sounding. Picture's not of you, but of some stranger, actually. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number. We're taking calls and talking tech. I talked yesterday about Steve Jobs, but I realize that not all stations take both days of this radio show. So I probably, for those of you who hear me only on Sundays, should mention, of course, the retirement of Steve Jobs. Leaving Apple after 35 years at the company. There was a gap in the middle there. But you know what? Steve Jobs is Apple. And it was very clear, actually, when Steve left, when John Sculley forced him out. And Apple tanked for some years, wandered in the wilderness. Then Jobs came back and completely recovered the company, made it, in fact, better than ever. Made it, today, one of the most successful companies in history. And its value on the stock market, I think it's number one, isn't it? It's bigger than Exxon. Maybe it went down a little bit, but it's right up there. But I don't think that Steve would measure his success in dollars and cents or stock price. I know he wouldn't. Because Steve Jobs wasn't about making money. Steve Jobs is about changing the world. And I think it's appropriate. I don't want to eulogize Steve Jobs. He's still with us, thank goodness. And God willing, will be with us for a lot longer. But he has decided to step down. He said, in fact, in his resignation letter that he'd always say, if he couldn't do the job, he'd be the first to say, I can't do the job. I need to step down. And that's exactly what his resignation letter was. He says, I'll serve as chairman of the board. I'd like to, if you'd let me. Tim Cook is ready to take the lead of this company. He's the current COO. He will be the CEO of Apple Computer. That was the plan, the secret succession plan that Apple has had all along. But you have to think that when Steve Jobs says, if I said I couldn't do the job, I would let you know. Well, that means I think that he's not well. He's not feeling up to doing the job he was born to do, the job he must have loved more than anything else. Certainly the job he put his heart and soul and passion into. And we are all the beneficiaries. There would be, you know, maybe we would have had a personal computer revolution without Steve Jobs, but it might have been very, very different. The personal computer had been around for several years before the Apple II came out. But it was the Apple II that really changed things. The IBM PC had been out for 3 years before the Macintosh came out. But the Macintosh really changed things. The iPod wasn't for the first MP3 player. It was just the best. Still is, 10 years later. iTunes completely changed the way we buy music, listen to music. It changed the music industry forever. The iPad, even though it's now only 2 years old, is clearly a revolution in how we think about computing. Something no other company could do. Microsoft tried to sell tablet computing for 10 years. Bill Gates put his heart and soul behind tablet computing. Couldn't make it happen. Then along comes Apple and the iPad, and boom. These things are huge. The iPhone wasn't the first smartphone, but it certainly made smartphones happen. And it changed the cell phone industry forever. Again and again, Steve Jobs took existing technologies, married them with brilliant design and an unflagging commitment to being the best, to his own vision and taste, and made amazing products, insanely great products, as he would say. And I think that's I think that's what he would like to be remembered for. And he should deserves to be remembered for. Somebody, Doc Searles, who was one of my heroes in the technology business, a great observer of technology and a great thinker of technology, called Steve Jobs the Beethoven of technology. I think that may be true. He's not. Don't think of him as a CEO or as a businessman. Think of him as an artist whose medium was the personal computer and consumer electronics. And boy, did he change everything. His leadership, I'm sure, will be missed at Apple. I know I heard it was a very somber place on Thursday when Jobs decided he was going to step down. That must have been a huge shock. And I know he's left Apple in good hands. I know that his DNA is in that company, and the way the company thinks about products, the way the company thinks about its customers, thinks about business. I know that he is, you know, he has indoctrinated, inculcated his vision into that company. And yet, you know, without the leader, it's very difficult. It's very difficult for a company to continue to innovate in the way it has. We'll see. We'll see if Apple can. I certainly hope they can. And I think the most important thing to do at this point is to just recognize Steve Jobs for what he's done for us. What an amazing man he is. What a force he has been. And how lucky, and I'm sincere when I say this, how lucky we are that we lived in a time when Steve Jobs was alive and we could partake of his creation. Pretty amazing. Really, truly an artist. And let's hope his health, he recovers his health and is able to spend more time with his family, more time doing the things he loves. I know it must really be difficult for Steve to step down. I know that he has so many things, I'm sure, in his mind that he would like to do still. You know, the last public appearance of Steve Jobs was just a couple of months ago in front of the Cupertino City Council in Cupertino, California, where Apple is headquartered, pitching them on Apple's new headquarters building. A building for 12,000 employees that is, I don't know if it was Steve who said this or some, or the press, but that looks like a spaceship that landed in Cupertino. This massive ring. He says, there's not a straight piece of glass in there. It's all curved. It's a work of art. And another monument, in a way, to Steve's creativity, vision, and implacable will. That building will get built. And I hope Steve Jobs is there to dedicate it in 3 or 4 years. But we will miss his input, I think, at Apple Computer. 888-88-ASK-LEO, 888-827-5536. That's the phone number. I know, you know, this show is on Sundays on KGO in San Francisco, which is the big talk station in Silicon Valley. And I know many Apple employees listen to the show. For all I know, Steve himself might accidentally hear it as he's driving about town in his Mercedes. I guess we all just owe him and his team a big thanks for what they've done. And, you know, I've been very critical of Apple in many, many respects. There's lots of things Apple does, especially lately, that I'm not fond of. But you cannot deny the works of art that they gave us. Just gorgeous. Woody in Long Beach, California, you're next. Hey, Woody, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo.
Hey, Woody, what can I do for you today?
Yeah, so my toddler, we got her this thing from VTech. They're the people that make the V-Reader.
They make great stuff. I love these VTech toddler toys. Yeah.
Yeah. I got her the MobiGo. It took me a while to figure out kind of the product positioning, but apparently the V-Reader is like the reading and the verbal, and then the MobiGo is kind of the math, arguably logic thing. And I didn't want to get her something.
Well, hold on a second. It's broken, I know. We're going to take a break and come back and try to fix it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Extreme. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 888-ASK-LEO. That is my number. We were talking before the break, and I had to cut him off to Woody in Long Beach. So you've got one of those VTechs, the MobiGo. Do you like it?
I really like it. I mean, a few games could use a little bit of work. They're kind of, it seems like some games don't really, as far as I can tell, they don't really teach anything, but most of them are pretty good, and it really engages her. I'll give them that. Like, it keeps her busy. She really seems to get the whole hand-eye coordination.
I think it's kind of the modern busy box. How old is your daughter?
She'll be 3 next month.
Yeah, so instead of a busy box, you give these kids this stuff, and they're ready for computing.
That's the thinking. You know, the only thing is, I didn't get her like an iPad or something like that, because obviously they're very expensive.
And a lot of 3-year-olds use mom and dad's iPad, but you're right. I mean, boy, I'd really worry about it.
Really want it.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing I got with this, and I was kind of thinking, well, this looks pretty designed for toddlers. apparently not. I mean, she dropped it one time. It wasn't as though she's terribly rough with it. And the touchscreen got this disordered pattern that looked like a fissure through the screen.
Yeah, that's a broken LCD.
Yeah, and
It's weird. When an LCD breaks, it looks so strange. It looks like a broken glass window, except it's black.
Yeah, and I was like, wow, this is supposed to be for three-year-olds. And I was thinking, is there like a Gorilla Glass? You know, like
but the real problem is that an LCD is inherently vulnerable, and it's just I don't know how they could make anything with a screen of any kind that would stand up to that kind of abuse. And that's the problem. I mean, you're right. A three-year-old is going to be throwing it across the room. My kid would have been. So
if only she was doing that. She really wasn't.
I know. It shouldn't break at all. In this case, what happens with LCDs, sometimes they hit wrong. It was bad luck, in other words. It hit just kind of at the wrong place where it just cracked. I would certainly go to VTech. The problem is, I don't know, I think VTech is not a U.S. company. I don't know where they're based.
They have a page on their website that says, you can talk to us, they give you a number, and then we'll talk to you about the cost of repairs and then shipping. And I mean, we're talking a $45.
Exactly. I mean, it's going to cost you more.
I would hope to avoid that.
Yeah, I think that you could look online for either a MobiGo screen or more likely just a used MobiGo.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't probably be too hard to take it apart, put a new screen in. I bet you that'd be fairly easy.
I did try to take it apart. It seems like not made to take apart.
Well, yeah, they may not put screws in. It's probably sealed plastic, right? So you'd have to split the plastic open.
And then there's some parts that you can't seem to take out without risking breaking.
Yeah, they're probably fusing the plastic together. I mean, at that cost, you're right. It's probably they consider it non-fixable, disposable. But I would call the store you bought it, or call VTech and say to them, "Hey, it broke within a week." They may well replace it. It's cheap for them to replace. How much do you think that costs them to make? $5. I think they could probably replace it pretty easily.
Yeah, you're right.
Or if you bought it with a credit card, sometimes credit card insurance. I wish there were a way to make these things more robust, but it's just in the nature of an LCD screen. E-ink screens seem to be a little bit more robust. I wonder why they didn't use e-ink. Well, it wouldn't be as interactive as in fast. I think, it's a computer. The fact that it was a $50 computer doesn't obviate the fact that it is a computer, and it isn't, it's fragile. I feel bad. I don't know what to say, Woody. It's probably a lesson for everybody. I think they price it that low because they figure, well, he'll just buy another one. Wish I had a better answer for you. Bryce in Virginia, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Bryce.
Hi, Leo.
Welcome to the show. What can I do for you?
Hi. I broke my video camera a few weeks ago.
Oh, man, I hate that.
I dropped it, and now it won't focus. But so I'm trying to sell my Nikon D50 online. And I've tried Craigslist, but I only get, scammers who, want you to send it to.
I stopped using eBay after I got a big scam.
Well, that was on Craigslist.
Oh, this is Craigslist. Yeah, same problem there, too. eBay, at least you have you can look at buyer's ratings. But even then, I the way that they handle that. I've read some, horror stories about the pressure that they give people not to put bad ratings on there. I stopped buying online, to be honest, from third parties online. It's just tough.
Okay.
So you had problems on Craigslist?
Yeah, I had some problems on Craigslist, so I made an eBay listing. But, I'm kind of worried it may not, sell. I did the thing where, you price it a little lower.
Think of Craigslist as really like classified in the paper.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. I mean, it's just hit or miss. But the nice thing about Craigslist is that a lot of people use it now. Probably as many people see it as the classified ad.
Yeah.
You're selling, one thing to look at is Gazelle. Gazelle does the same thing. They sell it on eBay. So you don't get as much money as you would get if you sold it. But they kind of give you the money up front.
Yeah.
So depending on how anxious you are to, and you're being very forthright about this thing doesn't focus, right?
Well, no, I'm not selling the video camera. I'm selling another camera.
Okay.
That does work.
Yeah.
And I did look at Gazelle, though the camera's really old. It's a D50, so it's.
You probably get, what, $100?
If that.
Yeah.
I don't think it was very much. And I'm trying to look at.
I would list it on eBay. I would list it on Craigslist. I would put it in your local paper.
Hmm.
You don't want to spend too much money listing it, you know, in the paper. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, what is your question? How do you publicize it?
Yeah, is there any good way to get the word out?
No, I think what you do is you just rely on the fact that so many people use Craigslist and eBay that somebody who's looking for a D50 will find your listing. You're just banking on that. And I think that's why these work, because they do. I think the negative on Craigslist is that it's regional. There's no way to search all the Craigslists. So you're in Craigslist, whatever, I don't know, Virginia. Somebody in the Bay Area who's looking for it won't see your listing unless he goes to Craigslist in your area. It's weird because Craigslist actually discourages people searching across all Craigslists. They don't want people to do that. I'm not sure why. You might also, the chat room is suggesting, and I think this is probably a good suggestion, visit camera forums. They have often, Darth Emma tells me, have classified ads there or for sale there. It's a little tricky when you're using, you're selling to a third party. And the nice thing about eBay is they do escrow accounts, so they kind of manage it. But publicizing it, I don't know. I mean, I think you're just banking on the fact that everybody is looking on Craigslist or looking on eBay for that kind of thing, which they are. I think they are. I would say eBay is probably, you're more likely to sell it on eBay than on Craigslist. So you can search all Craigslists if you put site equals Craigslist.org. Are you saying in Google, James? James DeRuvo, our show notes guy, saying you could search all Craigslist. The only reason I say you can is because my friend John C. Dvorak's son made a search tool that would search all of the Craigslists, and Craigslist made him take it down. So you're saying you Google it with the site being Craigslist.org. Yeah, I guess. I think some people probably know that trick. But I don't think on Craigslist there is a, and there should be, I wish there were, a thing that says search all the regional Craigslists for this item. I don't think they do that. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. Let's see, who's been holding on the longest? Alex in San Francisco is next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Alex. Hello, Alex. Come along. Come in. Hello, sir. Alex, are you there? I see on the line it says he wants to study abroad and he wants to know what phone to bring. It's a very common question. And, you know, the problem really is that we have a technology in the U.S. called CDMA that isn't widely supported worldwide. It's really a North American standard. It's an older standard. Everybody in the world uses GSM now. So Verizon and Sprint are CDMA carriers. Their technology is CDMA. They do have some world phones that support GSM, but really they're not a GSM carrier. AT&T and T-Mobile are GSM carriers. So what you're looking for is what they call a world phone. It'll be a phone that supports the GSM technology and has a radio that works in the bands you'll see around the world, quad band or tri-band. But if you look for a phone that says world phone, and Verizon and Sprint have them, but you have to look for them. You'll be all right traveling worldwide. But then there's the secondary issue, of course, that it's very expensive to roam. Roaming voice, of course, is expensive, and even more expensive is roaming data. And that's nice to have roaming voice because that means if somebody calls your cell phone number, no matter where you are in the world, it'll ring. Might cost you a buck or two a minute to talk to somebody, but it'll ring. So it's handy. Text messages can be very expensive as well. So ask your carrier before you travel about international data plans and international roaming. You'll see even the international data and roaming plans are still pretty expensive, but they're a lot better than not arranging for that ahead of time. Now, if you say you're going to be a student there, you're going to be there a while, then in that case, I wouldn't worry about it. I wouldn't bring a phone with me. I'd get an unlocked GSM phone, or maybe wait till you get to where you're going, get a phone there, and get a pay-as-you-go card in the locale. That way you'll have a local number, so your new friends in that country can call you on the local number. You'll have the ability to text locally. And you can give that international number to friends and family overseas. It's probably not, you know, it's going to be expensive, so it's probably best to use that locally. Maybe keep your old phone. Use it for emergencies or, you know, if they need to get a hold of you. Encourage most people to talk to you via the internet. Bring Skype with you. Make sure your friends and family have Skype at home set up. My daughter studied for a year in France, and I bought, I think it was $99 then, unlimited Skype out for a year, which meant she could call from her computer using the internet connection in France. She could call any phone anywhere in the world free. And that was great. That meant it was easy for her to reach us on our cell phones at home. If we were on the computer, we could do video calls. We have dozens of video calls. It was really a great way to stay in touch with her while she was in France via Skype. So it's really a combination of the two. And Skype will be free, or if you pay for Skype out, as little as $99 for a year. And I think that's a good choice. Todd, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Todd.
Hey, Leo. Can you hear me?
I hear you great.
Oh, great. Hey, just video question, but my two girls are watching on the Twit Network, Brent and Heidi, so if you just wave to them, that'd be great.
Hey, girls, how are you?
But your friend David Pogue for the New York Times recently wrote in his column about an article about these new cameras from Sony and Olympus, and it said that the two new cameras have the same quality photo-wise because of the big image sensor as a digital SLR. And he mentioned briefly that the video was a very, very good video as well. I remember listening to you and you having a discussion about how they shot an episode of House with a Canon digital SLR. So I know that video is good enough to shoot a network television show. My question to you is, this new conveniently small camera that has the same image quality for photo, is it as good for video?
I'll tell you why more and more you're seeing cameras like the 5D from Canon in movies and so forth is because they have interchangeable lenses. They are SLRs. So you're talking about one thing, which is the pickup, the quality of the image, and that's very, very good. And yes, many point-and-shoots have almost as good image quality, but the interchangeable lenses are why they use it for House, because you can use a wide lens, you can use a very narrow lens, you can use a fast lens, so it really looks filmic. It's, you know, that's big movie cameras have interchangeable lenses too, so that's why they're using them on TV shows. And you shouldn't expect that kind of result unless you have a thousands of dollars worth of lenses and camera. A point-and-shoot has a couple of disadvantages. One, you can't change the lens, but the other is that the chip size on these point-and-shoots are fractionally as big as on the 5D. The 5D has a pickup chip that's the size of a 35-millimeter negative. That's what we call a full-frame sensor. Having a bigger pickup means you get more detail, lots more detail. Not merely more megapixels, but more detail. You're also more light-sensitive. You can bring in more light. So if you want the quality of a 5D Mark II, you're going to have to buy a 5D Mark II. There's nothing that'll magically give you that quality.
Between $600 and $900, but there was an Olympus and a Sony, and I think what he was saying was the chip was close to the
I'm not sure which models he's talking about. Probably the Olympus pen cameras, the EP3. Those are Micro Four Thirds cameras.
And it's a brand new Sony that just came out. In fact, Best Buy had a big kiosk at it, so I don't know if it's a new technology or what, but it was his personal technology column a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, I'm looking at the let me just look real quickly. These are the NEX probably, yeah?
Correct.
Yeah.
And one was Olympus and one was NEX.
Now,
purchasing a point-and-shoot to get the best possible video, I guess that would be my ultimate question. What would be your personal choice? Because I'm real happy with the image quality of all these point-and-shoots. They look great, but I just wanted to get the best possible video out of it as well.
I'm not sure. What is the chat room? Do you know what the image sensor size is on the NEX? Because I don't think that they're 35 millimeter. I presume this is the NEX 7. Does that ring a bell? The NEX 7? If you want a $400 or $500 point and shoot, my recommendation probably would be the Panasonic GH2, which is not tiny. I mean, is it also compact that you want?
Well, I have that Kodak camera you recommended, which is great, but I just find myself wanting to...
Well, the ZI-8 is really a small chip. That's just, those are really just pocket cameras.
And I just wanted something that's a little better quality so I could do both photo and video.
Well, I mean, is it compactness that you're looking for?
Yeah, it's kind of in the middle. It's a little bit smaller than a little bit bigger than a Canon ELF, but not as big as a.
Well, in the Canon ELF range, I think the S95 is a very compact camera with excellent 720p video. So highly recommend that for video. Sometimes I think people want better quality video than they really need. I'm trying to find David's review, and I cannot find it off the top of my head. But so it's an APS-C. Yeah, that is a big sensor. It's not full frame, but it's two-thirds the size of full frame. So it's a nice big sensor, a lot bigger than a compact camera. But how much is the NEX 7? That's an expensive camera, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's frankly kind of a clunky looking camera because it's got a big old lens on it. I would say that my favorite would be the Panasonic GH2. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Got it.
Well, a good day to you. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Last hour of the Tech Guy Show this Sunday afternoon. Talking about computers, of course, and the internet and cell phones and camcorders and a lot about photography because I always love to talk about that. All the digital stuff, all the toys. 8888 Ask Leo is the number. 888-827-5536. We were talking before the break about getting a camera for video, a still camera for video. And I do have to say, nowadays, I don't think it makes any sense at all to buy a camcorder unless you're a filmmaker. Having said that, I just bought 30 camcorders for the new studio. But that's because, if you watch our video, that's what you're seeing. These are Canon Vixia H10 camcorders. They're consumer grade camcorders with great high def video, and they're really good for a television studio. But that's a kind of a special purpose. If you're you want to take pictures of the kids, you want to take pictures of the soccer game, the birthday parties, a good point and shoot still camera will do great video. And then you don't carry a bunch of stuff around and it's compact. I have recommended before, and I do love the Canon S95. That for compactness can't be beat and has great video. The Canon S95. But our caller last hour was really looking for something. He wanted something that was almost as good as an SLR. He mentioned David Pogue's article, which I've now read, saying these new cameras are as good as SLRs. And I disagree with David. I think I would not recommend the Sony cameras at all. Don't like them. Just don't like them. I think they're funny looking, uncomfortable to carry, uncomfortable to shoot with. I just don't like them. So, and now the other camera he recommended is a $1,600 camera called the Olympus Pen EP3. I have its originator, the EP1. And yeah, those are great. This is a new camera system called the Micro Four Thirds system. We're talking about sensor size. The bigger the sensor, the better. Not because it's got more megapixels, but because it's got more detail, more resolution, and it can bring in more light. So a big sensor is good, but of course a big sensor means a big camera. So there's this compromise and bigger costs. There's this compromise. I think the Micro Four Thirds is an interesting choice. They give you the flexibility of interchangeable lenses, which is one of the benefits of these very expensive SLR cameras, but a smaller chip and no mirror. They're mirrorless. Now, that gives you another disadvantage because an SLR, you're looking right. That's what it means, single lens reflex. You're looking, using mirrors, right through the lens. You see exactly what you're going to get. You see exactly what the lens is doing it. And you see it not through video, but just optically, right through the camera. And there is nothing like it. It's really, I mean, if money is no object, if you're a millionaire and you want a new camera, there's no question. Get a Canon 5D Mark II or a Nikon D3. Those really high-end, beautiful SLRs give you great images, very good video, movie studio quality video, and the experience is great. But they're big, they're clunky, and they're, you know, we're talking $3,000 to $5,000 here. The Micro Four Thirds, usually they're around $1,000. The EP3 from Olympus is an example of a Micro Four Thirds camera. The real advantage of the EP3 is its incredible focus time. It's the fastest focusing camera I've ever seen. You'll never miss a picture. The disadvantage of it is it doesn't have a viewfinder. You're looking at the LCD on the back of the camera, and some people don't like that, especially in bright sunlight. I happen to be a real fan of the Panasonic Lumix GH1, which I bought, and now the GH2. Also Micro Four Thirds. What's nice is all Micro Four Thirds cameras have the same mounts, so you can buy camera lenses from this, all the same companies, you know, Panasonic, Olympus, anybody who makes a Micro Four Thirds camera. That's nice. Gives you more choices in the lenses. It's expensive. The GH2 is $1,000, but a really nice camera. It's big, you know, fairly big, but it has interchangeable lenses, good choices of lenses. The kit camera comes with a 14 to 42 millimeter lens, which is pretty good. That'll give you a pretty broad range from wide angle to slightly telephoto. I think that would be my recommendation. And boy, the video is great. Full HD, beautiful video. So if that's what you're looking for, if you're looking for a camera that you could shoot nearly movie studio quality video, a great still camera, interchangeable lenses, not as big or as clunky as a SLR, not as expensive as an SLR. That's a good choice. Let's go to Silverado Canyon, California. Dick is on the line. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Dick.
Hello, Leo. How are you doing?
Very well. How are you, sir?
Welcome to amateur radio.
Why? You know, I can hear the voices now. When I hear these guys, I go, you're a ham, aren't you, Dick?
You got it.
What's your call sign?
W1 November Mike Zulu.
Wow, that's great. And you've been doing this for a while, I think, with a W1 NMZ. You're a long-time ham.
Oh, I got my license back when rocks were still hot.
Well, it's really great to be part of this fraternity. I'm really really thrilled. So
they're a great bunch, Leo.
Thank you. Thanks for the welcome.
Now I got a question.
Yes.
I am the proud owner of a brand spanking new Lenovo laptop.
Great brand.
With the i7 and, you know, power steering and white sidewalls and everything.
Fins!
And it has a 500-gig hard drive.
Okay.
I'm giving serious thought to purchasing Intel makes a 600-gig solid-state drive.
You don't need that big. I bet they're that. How much does that cost?
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's probably not cheap.
No, I can guarantee you it'll be probably $1,000.
But is there an advantage to going to a solid-state hard drive?
Yeah, there's advantages and disadvantages. They are much faster. In fact, you'll see with a solid-state drive, boot times go down from a minute or two to 10, 15 seconds.
Uh-huh.
Application launches go from 10 seconds, 20 seconds to one or two. So that by itself makes the computer feel lots faster. I like solid-state drives for that reason. Problem with them is that they're expensive for the capacity. So,
the only drawback, though?
Yeah. Sometimes people say, oh, well, those drives are going to wear out faster. That's not been the case.
What I was wondering is reliability, durability.
They're more durable because they're solid. There's no spin. It's in a laptop. They're more durable.
Yeah.
To be honest, all my new computers have solid state drives. I've gotten spoiled. I put one in my laptop and I never went back. Now, even my desktops come with solid state drives. I pay more for that. And so what I recommend is that you'll know better than I, but do you need 500 gigs? I'd recommend maybe a 250 gig.
Well, I run CAD cam on my laptop.
Oh, you might need it.
And I don't even own a desktop anymore.
Yeah, see, on a desktop, like the one that's sitting in front of me right now, I have a solid-state boot drive where my operating systems, Windows and Mac, and all my apps are on the solid-state drive, but then I have a terabyte data drive, so I don't worry about storage, but that's because I can have two drives in this desktop. On a laptop, most laptops don't accommodate two drives. If they do, that's not a bad way to go. Get a smaller solid-state drive for apps and operating system and use the bigger spinning drive for data. You're going to have to figure out what size you need, and since you're a ham, you're probably used to spending a little bit of money.
Yeah.
You just tell the wife it costs $54. Everything costs $54.
Well, the good news on this one is that for me, it's deductible.
Good. It's business.
It's a business expense. I just wanted to make sure that if I make this business expense, I'm not going to pound myself on the head again.
You won't. I'm very comfortable with the reliability and durability of solid-state drive, so much so that that's all I use. Visit PCPER.com. And look at their SSD decoder to find out what brands are good and what aren't. That's very important. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, episode 800 of the Tech Guy Show. But that's just since we started counting. We started counting in 2004 when I started to do the Tech Guy on KFI in Los Angeles, January 2004. But I'd been doing computer talk radio for 20 years. So I don't know. Somebody should do the math for me. Two shows weekly for 20 years. You do the math. It's more than 800. I know that. 8888 Ask Leah. We were talking about solid-state drives. This is maybe the single biggest advance in computer speed in the last 10 years. No, yeah, it's not the gigahertz, the triple gigahertz chip. It's not the 5, 6, 7, 8 cores, whatever it is, in a chip. I mean, I'm almost all my computers now have 8 cores or at least 4 cores in them. A core is what we used to think of as a processor. In the original IBM PC, you had an 8088 processor. That was the name of it. One core. Running at 4.77 megahertz, 4.77 million cycles per second. We now typically, on a typical inexpensive PC, not a netbook, but an inexpensive laptop, or let's use a desktop PC, we typically will have 4 cores, each running at 2 billion cycles per second. Lots faster. And yet, with all that processor speed, it's the hard drive that makes the big difference. And that's because what happens is we have so much speed now that we are what they call in the business I.O. bound. I.O., it's off to work I go. I.O. stands for input output. And when you say we're I.O. bound, what engineers are saying is that the bottleneck is input output. It's not the processor. In fact, the processors have outpaced the hard drive for years. Faster processors doesn't mean a faster experience if you're waiting around for the hard drive to spit out data. So we're I.O. bound these days. And that's why solid-state drives are making such a difference. The solid-state drive is using the same technology that's in your camera, the memory in your camera or your phone. It's flash memory. And it has one real advantage, a couple of advantages. One real advantage is the access time is zero. It's random access, just like your RAM in your computer, which means, you know, on a hard drive, there's a seek time. That's the amount of time it takes for the head to find the data. It has to move around as the drive is spinning and then you go, and find it. And that seek time really can add up over time. There is no seek time. The seek time is effectively zero on a solid-state drive. It just goes right to where the data is. Boom. It's all electronic, right? Also, read and write speeds are much, 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 much faster. Read more so than write. So you combine zero access time with, you know, much faster read times, you've got a faster drive. Now, you're not going to see the benefit unless you also have a faster bus. See, when you're I.O. bound, when the I.O. is the bottleneck, the fast drive can also be bottlenecked by how quickly it can send data on the motherboard. That's the bus speed. So we've also seen great improvements in bus speed. All of that has combined to make computers faster, as much or more than the faster chips. But not all solid-state drives are made alike. So I do recommend you go to PC Perspective, pcper.com, and you check it out. Alan Malventano, who's my personal solid-state drive guru, has put together something he calls the SSD decoder. It's over there. There's tabs right at the top at pcper.com. It's right there on the right, SSD decoder. And he keeps this up to date. Since June 2009, he's been adding data to this so that you can see what these drives are capable of. Not only their speeds, but also things like, do they support the trim command, which is a fairly important way to keep these drives at top speed, things like that. And you'll see that the reviews are not of necessarily of the make of the drive or the model of the drive, very much tied to the controller. Intel makes a controller, but so do other companies. The controller that I believe Alan likes today is the SandForce. Intel's more expensive. It may be the X25 drives, maybe the creme de la creme, but they're very pricey. So you might want to look at a SandForce-based drive. Corsair, Mushkin, Patriot, OCZ, all sell SandForce-based SSDs. The other critical factor is the kind of flash in it. Most inexpensive or less expensive drives use MLC. The very fastest drives use SLC. That would be something like the X25E. These you will pay a high price for indeed. So read this decoder and then read the reviews. You may not need to spend all that money on an SLC drive. You may find that it's perfectly fine to have an MLC drive. You're going to get such a speed improvement anyway. And it's funny, there is a debate over this trim command, which is kind of like, it's analogous to defragmenting a drive on a spinning drive. It's not the same, but it's analogous to it. Without the trim command, which, by the way, Lion, OS X Lion support, as well as Windows 7 support, without the trim command built into the hardware of the drive, the controller of the drive, the drives do slow down a little bit as they get used. And I talked to two guys who work in the Intel SSD division, and they didn't agree. One of them said, oh, you got to have trim. The other one said, well, it's not that much difference. They still are so fast that if you don't have trim, it's not a big deal. So there you go. I'd say get an MLC drive. They're fine. That's what I get. Trim is nice, but not necessary. And I think you'll find that the reliability of SSD, of solid-state drives, is actually higher. Fewer out-of-the-box failure rates and fewer failure rates in the first few years. They haven't really been in service long enough to know if they last 10 years. Some spinning drives, you're still in service 10 years later. I don't know if that's going to be the case with SSD, but my suspicion is SSD will be as reliable in the long run, as reliable as spinning drives. In fact, maybe more so. So don't worry about that. And you might, if you can afford it, you might consider SSD for your next computer. Richard is in the UK. Thank you for being so patient, Richard. Leo Laporte. Hey.
Hi, Leo. Hey, can you hear me?
I do. Thanks for calling.
Wow, I can't believe I'm live.
You're on the radio in the U.S. and around the world on the internet. Wow.
And I'm in Britain. Yeah. So I wanted to quickly talk to you about, well, the irony is we've kind of gone over what I wanted to talk about with both cameras and solid-state drives.
Oh, you're kidding. Oh, that's funny. You see, no, if you hang on long enough, we'll answer all your questions before you even get on the air.
I was going to, can I give you a bit of background into what I'm going to ask you about?
Sure.
I have a website, of course, only on Squarespace. It's www.themacbook1.com, themacbook1.com.
And what is the MacBook1.com? Is this your blog?
Yeah, I've got a blog and some other pieces on filmmaking, my hobbies, and I just wanted to go into a piece.
Good. Hang on, Richard, and we'll get to your question right after this break. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We were talking to Richard in the UK. Richard's got a blog called themacbook1.com, where he talks about filmmaking and tech. Hi, Richard. Welcome back. So you are you a filmmaker? Or are you interested in filmmaking? What's the filmmaking connection?
I started in 2005 doing a Doctor Who parody with the excellent software Windows Movie Maker, and they did my visual effects like lasers in Microsoft Paint.
Well, that's amazing.
If you go onto my website, there's like a segment at the top, the navigation bar called Asperger Syndrome Awareness. It's a form of autism I'm diagnosed with, and I've been doing a lot of work recently in local schools and talking to local governments and so on to try and help raise awareness.
Good on you. I know a number of people with Asperger's. You know, a very prominent actor in Hollywood has Asperger's, so it's certainly not in any way, it doesn't need to be debilitating. And I think that's a good thing is to raise people's awareness.
Well, the next big kind of movie project I'm working on is hopefully a feature-length piece, and I'm buying a new laptop and new camera, new equipment, everything pretty much, and I set up a little donation piece on my site. My first of two questions was, how do you think I could help start to kind of get the word out there about this?
People are always doing this to me. It's a little disingenuous. Of course, you know the best way to do it would be to get on a technology radio talk show that reaches a million people in the United States and hundreds of thousands worldwide and mention your site. That would be one way to do it. I'll tell you what, give you a big plug, themacbookone.com. You know, it's always a little tricky to promote this kind of fundraising thing. It's often the case that people try to build community after the fact. I think of this in a lot of different respects. You're going along in life, everything's going great, and something horrible happens. A loved one dies, and you go to church or you go to synagogue or the temple or you go to a community group and you try to and you get some help and support and love and unfortunately the problem is you wait until you need it before you go get it. And you haven't built those bonds. You haven't built that community. So it's not as satisfying as it could be. It's the same thing with promoting your project on the internet. The time to start building your community is now. Don't wait till you've written the great American novel or the great British novel. Don't wait until you've got that film you want to promote. Don't wait till you've got a podcast or a blog. Start now. Participate in the internet. Go to websites where you share interests, forums. Participate, communicate. You don't have to have even a website of your own to start posting forum messages and helping people and building community so that when the time comes that you need it, let's hope it's not because of a disaster, but in fact because you've got a film you want to promote or a cause you want to raise. But unfortunately, the time to build that community, it's a little late when you say, well, I want to raise money now. It's going to take a little while to build the community, right? The community just doesn't spring up because you need it. So for everybody listening, now's a good time to think about that and maybe start participating. The more you participate in the internet now, the more you give now, the more likely people will give later. However, I think coming on the radio show is a good start, Richard.
Yeah, well, I did recently become a YouTube partner, so that's a big thing.
Hey, that's huge. That's a hard thing to do. Congratulations.
And, the thing about this film was I've been reading books and seeing a few documentaries, and they've all been so negative. I want to make a film where it's kind of upbeat, you know, the happy ending kind of, you know, film that people of the condition, people without the condition can look at it and kind of go, you know, that's a good thing.
I agree. I support you 100%. I'm very glad to give you a plug. And the donation button's right on the front there. You click on the link that says Asperger's Syndrome Awareness, and then the very first post there talks about the movie project. Have you gone to places like Kickstarter.com?
I was considering it, but I was a bit nervous about using that. I don't really know why. I think it was because I'm uneasy just using sites that I'm just not familiar with, really.
Yeah, and it's the idea is that by going on a site where it's designed around raising funds for a project, and they do a lot of movie projects, by the way, mm-hmm. You're more likely to find people who are looking for that kind of thing to support. So I think Kickstarter is probably a very good place for you to do this as well, Richard. You got to go where the people are, right? So yeah. It's one thing, and I certainly think you should do this, to have a link on your site. In fact, what you'll want on the Kickstarter project is a link back to your site with lots more information than you can put on that Kickstarter page. So you're starting off well. But I do think the advantage of using something like Kickstarter is it makes others more comfortable with donating.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Question I had was about, we'd already kind of covered it with Solid State Drives, and it's just that I'm going to be on a bit of a budget with this, and I'm looking at a MacBook Pro, and the cost of what storage I need, if you get me, is going to cost me nearly an extra $1,000.
Don't go Solid State on that, Richard, because you're doing video editing. You need a lot of storage. You need the biggest storage you can get, not the fastest. You're just going to have to be patient.
Okay.
It's not, you know, perhaps I've oversold solid state drives. It's a great luxury for people like me who are very impatient, but it's certainly not a necessity.
I was going to say, listening to your podcast network, listening to people like, you know, on your MacBreak Weekly show, I've been scared stiff of getting a regular hard drive.
No. In fact, don't. And I think I perhaps have oversold this a little bit. For you, you need the capacity, and a solid state drive will just be too expensive.
Okay, cool. And I just wanted to say, really, before that's me done, is if you just look on the very front page of my website on the article, Where Else Am I Online? There's a little, I just literally edited it during my break on Squarespace.
That's the beauty of Squarespace, edited it on the fly. Isn't that great? Well, I see that, and thank you for the welcome and hello, and thank you for calling, Richard. Good luck with the film. Let us know. We'll continue to promote it. Keep working on it. Let us know when you make it available.
Thank you very much, and thank you to all your listeners and everything for this opportunity.
It's a good cause, Richard. And, you know, of course, Asperger's, which is kind of on the spectrum of autism, but not necessarily debilitating in any way, and I would say a great many people in the tech industry particularly, are perhaps Asperger's, or one might say on the spectrum of that. There's something about it that really lends itself to working with machines, feeling comfortable with machines, working well with computers, the focus, the intelligence that is often goes along with it. It just means, I think, that there's a higher percentage of people with Asperger's in the tech business. And there are a number of well-known technology. I'm not going to say any names, but there are a number of very well-known technology folks who, just on the surface, you might think, boy, you know, there might be some Asperger's there. Bruce in Irvine, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. How are you doing today?
I'm well, Bruce. How are you?
Great. I talked with you last week. This is a nice segue from the other guy's charity that he was just talking about. I was talking about last week, ridesforvet.net. I need some information on that.
Yes, that was great.
And I'll tell you what, you got a great following there. I got a lot of emails, people making suggestions. I ended up doing the Instamapper, and I just put that on my website right now, and I'm actually going to go for rides since your show's over and test it out. But it's
ridesforvets.net.
Right.
And people want to see it. And so you're going to use the Instamapper and go for a ride so we can follow you?
Yeah, I'm going to go in about 20 minutes.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and get it going. I wanted to ask about...
Well, hang on. I know you got a question, so hang on. We'll get to you in a sec. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Yeehaw!
Woohoo! Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888... Ask Leo, last segment of the day. Let's finish up, though. We were talking with Bruce from Irvine, ridesforvets.net, and he's about to go out on a ride. What kind of bike you ride, Bruce?
Well, it's a road bike, but it's one of those lightweight carbon fiber bikes.
Oh, man.
But I think I'm about to weigh it down with my next question.
Okay.
The ride starts at ground zero on September 11th, obviously, and we do go to Shanksville, and we go to the Pentagon, and you had mentioned something last week, you just kind of made a side comment. I go, hey, that's a good idea about putting a camera on the bike.
Oh, yeah.
And see as we're writing, you know, start at ground zero. They can watch it from there. And as we're going up to Shanksville and down to the Pentagon. And I kind of looked on the internet and looked at things. I really didn't find anything. I mean, what?
Well, the issue is going to be not the camera, but how do you get the signal back?
Yeah.
I mean, you could be easy enough to do is if you have a smartphone with 3G service, there's certainly, you know, there's a number of companies. There's Quik, Q-I-K, probably the best known, but there's others that will stream live video from your camera using 3G. So if you had a little mount for your cell phone, your iPhone or your Android phone on the handlebars and you launched Quik, you had a Quik account, you could absolutely stream it out over 3G to Quik. And then you could put it up on the put it embedded on the website just as you've embedded Instamapper on the website, and that would be one more thing people could see. Ustream also has Justin.tv also has apps for smartphones. Same idea.
Okay. So not necessarily get another camera, just use my phone.
Well, what
it.
You would need with the camera is connectivity.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
So you already have a device that has connectivity and a camera. So
why
buy anything else? Now, if you're looking for the best camera for kind of taking pictures of active sports, the GoCam is amazing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, GoPro, GoPro.com. They make helmet cams. They make small cameras. They're high def. They can be mounted on the bicycle handlebars. But they don't stream. But what you do is you might have this and your phone shoot high quality with GoPro.
Right.
Yeah, when you get back, then you can post your videos. They have a lot of videos online of people doing exactly this, kayaking, bungee jumping, surfing, base jumping, driving race cars, skiing, speed flying. I don't even know what that is, but it sounds sounds dangerous. I'll tell you, it's a great site just for the videos. And the quality on these is really good. You know, you might have seen the YouTube video of the guy who had a GoPro camera that was stolen by a seagull. And you get this great video of the seagull flying it away. He recovered it later. But these do not stream. So I think your cell phone is kind of the ideal streaming device. You've already got it.
It's just, I just need to get a little extra battery power because I'll be uploading I think it drains the battery.
Oh, you bet. You bet. It wouldn't be good. Wouldn't be good for all day. That's for sure.
Yeah. Well, doing anywhere from 70 to 100 miles a day, and that's about a 5-hour period. So I don't think my phone will last that long.
You need a generator.
Yeah.
But you can buy extra batteries. You know, that's an argument against the iPhone, and although they have cases that are basically extra batteries, and then the Android phones, almost all of them, you can replace the batteries. Charge up 3 or 4. You just snap them new one in. It's easy.
Yeah, well, I'll have to give that a try. But I really, I was calling to thank you for the lead on that and the response from your people. I had a guy, I had somebody contact me all the way from Germany, Johannes, I think was his name,
We have wonder. This is what I was talking about with community. I've always felt so supported by our community. We have an amazing community, and I'm always very grateful.
I just had emails and suggestions, and I had this guy in Germany that says, hey, if you need me to embed that for you, I can do that for you. Or he told me how to do it. And I said, I think I can figure this out. And I had a couple questions, and he helped me out.
Awesome. That's really great.
Yeah.
Well, good luck. Keep in touch, and I'd love to know more. Ridesforvets.net. We're coming up on September 11th. There are going to be 2 weeks away. There are going to be a lot of commemorative events, but this sounds like a really good one. And for a very good cause, our wounded warriors out there, it's ridesforvets.net. Let me take a little break, come back. We'll talk with more of you. We have, Wade on the line from Canada, from Alberta. He wants to tell us about a problem with Time Warner that's not just limited to Canada, Wade. And Jenna, if we have time in Tennessee, wants to get her new laptop online. Jim in Woodland Hills, you're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Yeah, Leo, I've got the cheapskate question of the day.
Okay.
I'm one of those rare people that still has rabbit ears hooked to my antenna because the digital signal comes in just fine, but that means...
That's not cheap. You get it's the best deal in HD, right? If you've got digital HD, if you live somewhere where you can get digital HD over the air, it's the best HD.
But my problem, though, and what I wanted to find out, do you know of anything I can use that would be the equivalent of a VCR? Because I can't use a DVD-R that's connected to a cable box because I don't have cable. So I don't know if they still even make anything that uses VHS tape, but there may be something with a hard drive equivalent. But it would have to, the antennas, in essence, would have to go directly into that.
Right.
As opposed to, you know.
There's something called a Channel Master. It's one of the few analog, or not analog, but over-the-air DVRs. Most of them want a cable box or a satellite box, or more likely, they come with the cable company. So Channel Master is one not very expensive. Of course, you can also do it on your computer with an over-the-air television dongle that will pick up the antenna signal, use your computer as a recorder or TV.
I have an 11-year-old PowerBook G3. That
Don't do that. Although this could be an excuse. This could be an excuse. I'm wondering, let me see if TiVo does an over-the-air solution. You know, they certainly used to. Yeah, TiVo does, as a matter of fact.
Do you buy the thing separately, the TiVo unit?
That's a good question. TiVo has an over-the-air antenna receiver, and then it would hook up to a regular TiVo, I guess. It might be expensive. It sounds like you'd have to buy, you'd have it, yeah. There's Series 3 TiVos work over the air. So, yes, you can even use a TiVo. That would be my recommendation. TiVo's the best.
Huh. Well, if I did do the Channel Master thing, though, where do you buy, I mean, is that only online?
Yeah. I mean, I would say with everybody buys online now, right? I don't know where you would go in Woodland Hills, but I'm sure if you go to a good TV store, do they even have those anymore? If you go to a good TV store, you'll find somebody who might sell it. I like TiVos. You know where I would go, actually? Jim, call Weak Knees. It's online, but they do have a store in your area, actually. Maybe it's more like a warehouse. WEAKNEES.com. These guys are the TiVo experts. They do aftermarket upgrades and all sorts of stuff. I really like them. Weak Knees. Wade, Alberta, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo.
So your Time Warner's out, huh?
Well, I don't. I've just been hearing about it being out. And then I've got...
Is there Time Warner in Alberta? You guys have Alberta Time Warner?
We have Rogers.
You have Rogers. That's what I thought.
Yeah. Rogers and Telus and Bell and...
So Time Warner did have an outage in Southern California. I think it's back now. Isn't that right? So there was an outage. I'm not sure what the story is behind the outage, and I understand it's back. These things happen. They were down this morning. Maybe not everywhere. Not in Alberta. Finally, Jenna. Oh, I'm not going to have time. Jenna, will you call me next week? We'll get you on the air. I ran out of time, as always. There's never enough time to talk tech. Hey, thank you for being here. Have a great geek week. We'll see you online at techguylabs.com. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy.